Hello, this is Joe Penrod with the News Gazette for Sunday, September 27th. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article entitled, Just Give Us a Chance, Debate Over Officers Once Again Ignited in Urbana. This article is written by Anthony Zillis of the News Gazette. Before Michelle Robinson began her job as the school resource officer at Urbana Middle School late last year, she had a nickname as a patrol officer. I was the mom officer, she said. When I talked to people, I was the mom laying down the law. Robinson enjoyed her beat, working in the same area where she grew up. She went to high school with some of the people who still lived in the area, and she tried her best to build a rapport with those she didn't know. When the Urbana School Board voted last November to commission 2 full-time school resource officers, Robinson realized the job would be a perfect fit. After all, she has a degree in elementary education and a background working in the mental health field, where she helped people who had been institutionalized readjust to normal life. She wanted to help troubled youth, she said, and thought becoming a police officer would be the best way to do that. The job has been everything she expected. She has built relationships with kids and adults who may have had negative interactions with police, engaging with them in different ways than she would have when she was on a call. She has helped students who became comfortable around her, telling her about bullies who wouldn't leave them alone. She has participated in restorative circles along with social workers, helping them resolve conflicts in a non-punitive way. She wears a polo and khakis as part of a more relaxed uniform, although she still has a gun attached to her hip. And of course, she has used that stern, motherly voice when necessary. Most of the time when I'm talking to kids, even if it's something where they've done something and a parent of the victim is wanting me to take a report and I have to give them the spiel, I look at it as a mom tone, she said. The point of it is to correct their behavior. Not necessarily punish them, but correct their behavior so they can learn from what they've done and from what will happen if they continue that behavior. After only a few months on the job, schools across the state went fully remote in March, and students in Urbana haven't been back since. Now, whether Robinson's job should even exist is up for the debate. At its 2 most recent meetings, the school board discussed whether it would be possible and advisable to amend the contract with the city, which costs the district $327,007 for 2 officers, given the fact that the officers can't perform their intended functions without students in school. That comes after nationwide protests for police reform and divestment swept across the country, and calls for the removal of school resource officers have reignited locally. Robinson and her high school counterpart, Chad Burnett, fulfill a wide variety of roles. Now, Urbana residents and the school board are once again wrestling with the question of whether armed police officers are the most qualified people for the job. People say, they're great people, they're mentoring students, but the argument is not about the school resource officers as people, said 2007 Urbana graduate Amina Payne, who filed a petition to remove the officers from schools. I'm sure they're doing their job, which is policing in schools, and I'm sure some of them do go above and beyond and take on these mentorship roles, but it's important to realize that that's not their job. They are there for criminal activity. There are other roles that are more appropriate, such as truancy officers, youth counselors, social workers, implementing programs that may address the root causes of what may be considered behavioral issues in the school. The initiative to install full-time officers at Urbana's high school and middle school was spurred by a fight in February of 2019 that resulted in 11 arrests and left a teacher briefly hospitalized. I have seen those videos. It was chaos, Champaign County State's Attorney Julia Reitz said. And the teachers and the staff were not able to deal with it. And one of them got seriously hurt when she tried. Since 1993, when a school resource officer was first installed in the district, one officer worked what was generally considered a half-time position. After the fight, an officer was stationed at the school full-time. Later that year, a plan was put forth to install officers at both the high school and middle school, and in November, the board approved a 2.5-year contract that would cost the district $327,007 per year in salaries, benefits, and other costs. Two officers with education backgrounds, Robinson and Burnett, a former teacher, took on the roles. Both took a 40-hour training course, and Robinson said she's always eager to take whatever professional development training comes her way. When Superintendent Jennifer Ivory Tatum was asked at the most recent school board meeting whether she'd like the program to continue, she nodded her head emphatically and said, "Yes." "I think we have the opportunity to do something great," Ivory Tatum told the board. "It's very unique that we have two individuals in the people that we have in SRO Robinson and SRO Burnett, in their temperaments and their backgrounds and their commitment to Urbana." The debate about school resource officers goes far beyond last November's board decision. Danielle Chinoweth has been involved with discussions surrounding the officers since 2001, shortly after she was elected to the Urbana City Council. During her first meeting, she opposed a measure to increase the number of officers in schools. Over her 7 years on the council, she worked with officers to address the negative long-term legal impacts interactions with police might have. Chinoweth, who is now the Cunningham Township supervisor, was disappointed in the decision to increase police presence in the two schools. "The investment in school resource officers was reactionary, and it was a reaction to a specific moment in time that has passed," Chinoweth said. "So what we need to do, instead of being reactive, is we need to be proactive in investing in education and kids and racial justice and not reactive in terms of policing and surveillance and punishment." At a meeting last fall, Urbana Police Chief Bryant Serafin pointed out that of the 35 arrests made by the school resource officers over the previous 5.5 years, only one resulted in charges. 24 of the students who were arrested were referred to the Youth Assessment Center, which uses restorative justice practices as an alternative to prosecution. The school-to-prison pipeline, referenced in many public comments at city council and school board meetings, simply does not exist in Urbana, Serafin said. The argument, though, isn't quite that simple. Referrals to the Youth Assessment Center become part of a student's record and are considered in criminal cases down the line. "It's a diversion program, so ideally the young person takes advantage of the opportunities and resources that are provided by the Youth Assessment Center, and we never see them again in the criminal justice system," Reitz said. "Now, if they fail the formal station adjustment that they're put on through the Youth Assessment Center, if they continue to violate the law, then yeah, we're going to know that they had opportunities, and that's something that we're going to have to take into account." In working with low-income and homeless residents in her role as township supervisor, Chinoweth has seen the real-world implications of building up a juvenile record. "Ultimately, I have met school resource officers who are friendly, who are kind, and who are supportive, but it's not about the person," she said. "It's about the function. The function of an officer is that when they see something happen in the school, they view it through the lens of the criminal justice system, and they begin a process that ends with a young adult having the state's attorney dig up that child's record and say they have prior records as juveniles. And that's how misdemeanors get turned into felonies, and that's how the participants at the township have barriers to housing and unemployment. It starts in school with the tracking through police contact, and it's inappropriate for schools to embrace that. That's not their mission or their function. If the officers are fulfilling their intended purpose, though, the idea is that the crimes that lead to arrests might not occur in the first place." "A school resource officer like Robinson," Serafin said, "can build relationships and use them to help stave off problems before that happens. They can also bridge issues that take place outside of school, which staff may not normally be aware of, with potential issues inside the school. What I found interesting is the idea that SROs are vital in working with staff and students in anticipating some of these issues so that small things don't become big things, Serafin said. The ability for Michelle to plug into these school groups was amazing to me. You have somebody that can plug in there and that knows who the children are that need more support. When she's involved at the lower end of the spectrum, we don't get to the higher end of the spectrum. For REITs, the choice between solving the problem at its root and making sure schools are safe is a false one. Can't we do both, she said? Can't we ensure that our schools are safe and address the root causes? Why does it have to be one or the other? We can't pretend that our young people are not involved in serious crime, she added. The vast majority of the gang violence that we're seeing right now involves young people carrying guns. Do we want them carrying those guns in our schools? Do we want to not have somebody who's able to address those situations? Of course, every dollar spent on school resource officers is a dollar not spent somewhere else. And the $327,007 spent each year can go a long way. You can buy 3,000 Chromebooks with the $320,000 used for SROs, Chenoweth said. You can buy a teaching assistant for every classroom in my son's school. You can buy 7 social workers. At township assistant levels, you can buy rental assistance for 533 families. Or you can buy 10,658 days of hotel room stays for homeless families. Payne sees a better way to replicate many of the functions of a school resource officer with workers who are trained to address trauma, conflict, and mental health issues without introducing children to the criminal justice system and the endemic racial justice issues that come along with it. SROs in schools contribute to these negative outcomes, and they don't actually have any positive effects on student learning and safety, Payne said. There's lots of academic, peer-reviewed, scholarly work out there to support these alternate approaches. And it's just about doing something different and believing in a system that's different than what we're used to. After the city council voted this month to allow the school board to amend its contract, the board rejected that idea by a 5-2 vote the next day. That means Robinson and Barnett will keep their beats inside the schools, although several board members discussed revisiting the conversation soon on a philosophical level rather than a budgetary one. Robinson hears the protests. As a black woman, she's well aware of racism and bias that takes place in all forms, including policing, she said. But she contends that there's plenty of good they can do for students and families. For now, she and Barnett are making house calls to deliver supplies to students and to help families in other ways, along with providing security at the school entrances. When students return, she's looking forward to gathering groups of at-risk kids and continuing the relationships she began building last year. For the detractors, she has one plea. Just give us a chance, Robinson said. If in 2 years you don't like how it's going and you still feel the same way, then okay, we tried to prove ourselves. But just give us an opportunity to prove ourselves, because you're going to be really surprised with what Officer Burnett and I have in store for the school and what we're going to do. We now turn to an opinion piece written by Tom Kasich of the News Gazette, also on page 1 of today's issue, entitled 13th District Race Seeing Less Spending from Outside Groups. 2 years ago, outside groups pumped more than $6 million into the 13th congressional district race between U.S. Representative Rodney Davis, Republican of Taylorville, and Democratic challenger Betsy Dirksen Londrigan. Groups as diverse as the Sierra Club, Women Vote, National Right to Life, and the National Rifle Association invested in the race, either with mail pieces, phone banks, or other forms of advertising not coordinated with the two campaigns. So far this year, though, outside spending in the rematch between Londrigan and Davis is down. The Center for Responsive Politics reports that total outside spending in the 13th District amounts to less than $920,000. Most of that, more than $720,000, is from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, devoted to negative ads against Davis. The Republican Governing Majority Fund has spent about $11,000 opposing Londrigan. Although total outside spending by super PACs, political parties, and dark money special interest groups is up this year to more than $1 billion, a record, much of that is going into the presidential contest. In the presidential race, outside spending backing Joe Biden or opposing President Donald Trump totals $247 million, compared to nearly $167 million spent boosting Trump or opposing Biden, the center reported. Overall spending on U.S. House races is down nationwide this year, the center said, because money is increasingly being dedicated to Senate contests, with more likely to come because of the pending Senate vote on Trump's Supreme Court nominee. A second poll recently released by the Londrigan campaign continues to show a tight race between the Springfield Democrat and incumbent Davis. Davis defeated Londrigan 2 years ago by 2,058 votes, or 50.4% to 49.6%. Londrigan's campaign said last week that its poll, about which no details were released, showed a statistical tie. Davis led 48% to 47, but that was well within the poll's margin of error of plus or minus 4.4 percentage points. Londrigan's campaign said the poll involved 500 likely voters and was taken September 17th through the 20th by GBAO Strategies, which works with other Democrats such as Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, State Treasurer Mike Frerichs, and Representative Sherry Bustos, Democrat of Rock Island. Another poll of the district taken 2 years ago at a similar time, September 9th through the 11th, gave Davis a 51 to 46% lead. Londrigan campaign spokeswoman Eliza Glazier said the most recent poll is significant because Davis's support is under 50% and Londrigan is in a better position to overtake him. Perhaps of equal significance is that the GBAO poll shows that Trump trails Biden in the district 51% to 44%. That lines up with another poll conducted in early August by RMG Research, which found that 53% of voters in the district disapproved of Trump's performance. That's a major turnaround from 4 years ago when Trump defeated Hillary Clinton in the 13th district 49.4% to 43.9%. Two local Illinois legislature candidates made it to the ballot but appear to be woefully underfunded against incumbents with plenty of campaign cash. Savoy Republican A.J. Ruggieri is running against Democratic State Senator Scott Bennett in the 52nd Illinois Senate District, which includes most of the population of Champaign and Vermilion counties. Ruggieri formed his campaign committee September 11th and reported $3,000 on hand. Bennett reported $290,000 on hand as of June 30th and has added at least $135,300 in contributions since. In the 103rd Illinois House District, Libertarian Brad Bielert of Champaign hasn't even formed a campaign committee with the Illinois State Board of Elections, indicating he hasn't collected $5,000. Meanwhile, his opponent, State Representative Carol Ammons, Democrat of Urbana, reported $48,321 on hand as of June 30th, with at least $7,500 more in contributions since. In early voting, some 800 people voted early Thursday on the first day of in-person voting in Champaign County, said County Clerk Aaron Ammons. Assuming an eventual turnout like the 92,842 who voted in the 2016 presidential election, that means about 0.86% of the county's voters have already cast their ballots 40 days before Election Day. Ammons said the average wait on the first day of voting was about 30 minutes. I voted Friday, the second day, and was in and out in 10 minutes. There are about 20 voting booths spread out in the spacious Brookins Gym, so it's a pretty safe environment. Also on page one, we have an article by Jeff D'Alessio of the News Gazette about the COVID rates in Champaign County, entitled Illinois Impact, 7-day rates remain low on campus in Champaign County. Three preschoolers among 27 Vermilion residents to test positive. Of 8,067 new tests in Champaign County, 42 came back positive Saturday, pushing its total to 4,549. Both the 7-day positivity rate, which is 0.5%, and number of residents hospitalized, 4, remained unchanged. Of the 18 county zip codes with any of the 350 active cases, just 4 saw increases in their total. Urbana, zip code 61802, up 3. Sadorus, up 2. Sydney, up 1. And Thomasboro, up 1. The 7-day positivity rate on the University of Illinois campus remained at 0.4% after 11,090 tests turned up 41 cases. Vermilion County finished a 103-case week with 27 more Saturday, including 3 preschoolers. Its total now stands at 630. Citing a nationwide shortage, Carle will make available a very limited supply of a high-dose flu vaccine to those 65 and older at 2 drive-through clinics from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday at Carle at the Fields in Champaign and Carle Urbana on Windsor Road. On page 3, we find an article about the upcoming presidential debates entitled How Trump Biden Are Preparing for First Matchup. Ahead of the first debate stage face-off between President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden, each campaign is promising a stark contrast in policy, personality, and preparation. Trump has decided to skip any formal preparation. And while Biden's team believes the significance of the debate may be exaggerated, the Democratic nominee has been aggressively preparing to take on the president. Biden's campaign has been holding mock debates featuring Bob Bauer, a senior Biden advisor and former White House general counsel, playing Trump, according to a person with direct knowledge of the preparations who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss internal strategy. Bauer has not actually donned a Trump costume in line with Trump stand-ins from previous years, but he is representing his style and expected strategy. I'm sure the president will throw everything he can at Biden. My guess is that they're preparing for that, bombarding him with insults and weird digressions, said Jay Carney, a former aide to Biden and President Barack Obama. I think it's an important moment. I think it's really important for President Trump because the direction of this election has been pretty stable for a long time now, and he needs to shake it up as any candidate would who's behind. Carney added, the question is, can that work? Trump and Biden are scheduled to meet on the debate stage for the first time Tuesday at Case Western Reserve University and the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. The 90-minute event, moderated by Fox News host Chris Wallace, is the first of 3 scheduled debates. Vice President Mike Pence and California Senator Kamala Harris, Biden's running mate, will also debate in October. For some, the debates represent the most important moments in the 2020 campaign's closing days, a rare opportunity for millions of voters to compare the candidates' policies and personalities side by side on primetime television. Trump has been trailing Biden in the polls for the entire year, a reality that gives the president an urgent incentive to change the direction of the contest on national television, if he can. Others, including those close to Biden's campaign, do not expect the debates to fundamentally change the race, no matter what happens, given voters' daily struggles with the pandemic and the economy. They also point to high-profile debates in past elections that were thought to be game-changing moments at the time, but that ultimately had little lasting effect. Those with knowledge of Biden's preparations suggest he will not take the fight to Trump if he can avoid it. But on Saturday, at least, he was on the attack when he discussed his strategy on MSNBC. I'm prepared to go out and make my case as to why I think he's failed and why I think the answers I have to proceed will help the American people, the American economy, and make us safer internationally, Biden said, arguing that Trump won't persuade voters with broadsides because, quote, the people know the president is a liar, unquote. He also compared Trump to Adolf Hitler's propaganda minister, saying he's sort of like Joseph Goebbels. They say the lie long enough, keep repeating, repeating, repeating. It becomes common knowledge. Biden said he doesn't expect Trump to articulate a detailed vision for a second term. He doesn't know how to debate the facts because he's not that smart, Biden continued. He doesn't know that many facts. He doesn't know much about foreign policy. He doesn't know much about domestic policy. He doesn't know much about the detail. While Biden has said he will try to be a fact checker of sorts on stage, the Democrat is being advised to avoid direct confrontations and instead redirect the conversation to more familiar campaign themes of unity and issues that matter most to voters, the economy, healthcare, and the pandemic. On Saturday, President Trump announced Judge Amy Coney Barrett to replace the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And on page 3, we have an article about this entitled, Nominee is Scalia's Heir. Although Amy Coney Barrett is the president's choice to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she is more aptly described as heir to another departed Supreme Court justice, conservative hero Antonin Scalia. Like Scalia, for whom she once clerked, she is a committed Roman Catholic and a devotee of his favored interpretation of the Constitution known as originalism. Those qualifications delight many on the right, but dismay liberals who fear her votes could result in the chipping away of some laws, especially the Roe v. Wade decision affirming a woman's right to have an abortion. The nomination of the 48-year-old federal court appellate judge from South Bend, Indiana, sets her on the path to help conservatives hold sway over the court for decades. It's as sure to energize the president's base as it is to galvanize his foes heading to Election Day. Beyond the election, Barrett's elevation could bring a national reckoning over abortion, an issue that has bitterly divided many Americans for almost half a century. Her writings and speeches show a commitment to originalism, a concept that involves justices endeavoring to decipher original meanings of texts in assessing whether someone's rights have been violated. Many liberals say that approach is too rigid and doesn't allow the Constitution's consequences to adjust to changing times. On abortion, questions have risen about Barrett's involvement in organizations that vigorously oppose it. But she has not said publicly if she would, if given the chance, seek to scale back rights affirmed by the High Court. Barrett has been a federal judge since 2017, when Trump nominated her to the Chicago-based 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. But as a longtime University of Notre Dame law professor, she had already established herself as a reliable conservative in Scalia's mold. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette for Sunday, September 27th. Please stay tuned.